Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
Years ago, last week, the Roman Catholic Church held its last church council called Vatican II. Perhaps you've heard about it. With one fell swoop, it changed the way most Catholics worship on Sunday morning. It brought Catholicism, or at least it was hoped to bring Catholicism into the 20th century. Has it brought Catholicism into the 21st? Was it necessary? And was it a success? Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about Vatican II, Ross Douthat. He's a regular guest and columnist for the New York Times. He's author of several books, including To Change the Church, Pope Francis, and the Future of Catholicism, and a recent column titled How Catholics Became Prisoners of Vatican II. Ross, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back.
Why do we often hear stories about older Roman Catholics? They visit a liturgical Lutheran church, and they say, that's the way it used to be for us before Vatican II.
Well, I mean, there's kind of an irony here, right, which is that Roman Catholicism is sort of imagined to be a much more sort of intensely liturgical sort of high church experience than even the high church parts of Protestantism. But what happened, the changes in Vatican II, which have ended up playing out very differently, and there's a lot of variation from Catholic Church to Catholic Church, but they've definitely created a landscape where some Catholic liturgies feel more Protestant in certain ways than especially older Lutheran or Anglican liturgies. I think Lutheranism went through its own reforms in the 60s and 70s, but what would have been the sort of traditional high church Protestant church service is going to often seem more pre-Vatican II Catholic than certainly like a Catholic mass in a parish center, you know, with guitar music in 1997, let's say.
So how did conservative Catholics interpret Vatican II as opposed to liberal Catholics?
So conservative Catholics, I distinguish between conservatives and traditionalists, right? So if we say traditionalist Catholics, we usually mean Catholics who still favor the Latin Mass, often have big problems with Vatican II. Conservative Catholics are more likely to be big fans of Pope John Paul II, and they would usually say, look, Second Vatican Council, it was a pastoral council. It wasn't supposed to say anything about doctrine or dogma. It was supposed to prepare the church for the modern world, to improve Catholic relations with the Jews, to sort of reconcile Catholicism to liberal democracy. And all of that is in the documents of the council, and all of that is good. And the problem was that after the council itself was kind of hijacked. And there was this kind of silly season in the life of the church where liberalizers interpreted the council as a license to basically take the church in more radical directions, to actually try and change church teaching on sexual morality, on various doctrines, and so on. But the core of Vatican II was just the council itself, and that was all good and necessary and fine.
What were the main reforms? You've mentioned them generally, but what were the main reforms that Vatican II sought to enact?
If you were a normal Catholic, an ordinary Catholic, not someone who read papal documents before breakfast, the big changes were all in sort of liturgical life. Mainly, it wasn't just that the Mass was shifted from Latin to English. It was that the whole structure of the Mass, the prayers, the cycle of readings, all kinds of things changed, right? So there was a genuinely new form of the Mass that basically for 99% of Catholics just fully replaced the older liturgy. But then accompanying that were just a lot of changes, like shifting from requirements to options, basically in a lot of areas of fasting and prayer and these kind of things. So the famous one would be Catholics famously did not eat meat on Fridays, right? And that was shifted from a sort of defining aspect of being Catholic to something that, you know, maybe you did during Lent, or maybe it was optional, or some bishops, you know, encouraged it, some bishops didn't. And there were a lot of things like that, where things that had been sort of formal rules of Catholic life, real Catholic distinctives, came to be seen as sort of up for grabs and optional all over the life of the church. And then there were also just changes connected to the changed mass, to church architecture. Statues were removed, sort of big old-fashioned altars were taken down, churches built in the 1960s and 1970s. Again, this isn't just Catholics, but they don't look like churches built in 1925, to say nothing of 1625. So there was a real transformation in people's lived experience of the liturgy and the everyday rules of Catholicism that went way beyond what the documents of Vatican II said about, say, religious liberty.
What changed regarding the reforms of Vatican II with the consecration of John Paul II?
Well, so with John Paul II, you had this kind of pullback, basically, where the sense in the church, especially in the Western world in the 1960s and 1970s, was that everything was up for grabs, everything was open for debate, that probably things like priestly celibacy were going to be on the way out, that the church was changing its point of view on sexual morality, changing its point of view on the sort of distinctiveness of the church, whether it was essential to go to confession, whether it was essential to believe certain things for salvation, and so on. And the John Paul pontificate is seen as a conservative pontificate because it basically tried to draw a bunch of lines. It basically tried to take what I just described as the conservative view of Vatican II and sort of give it formal papal authority to say, what's in the documents of Vatican II is the teaching of Vatican II. We do have a changed mass, a new mass, but the church is still the same church fundamentally as it was before the council. It still teaches the same things about morality and salvation and so on that it taught before. That was sort of the fancy sounding term, right, that Joseph Ratzinger, who became Pope Benedict XVI, used, was the hermeneutic of continuity. The idea that you were going to interpret Vatican II as being continuous with Catholicism as it has existed before, even though there obviously had been this rupture.
What shadow does Vatican II cast on the tenure of Pope Francis?
Well, so Pope Francis has, I think, fairly overtly brought back the idea that Vatican II was supposed to be a much more open-ended process, if you will, rather than just a sort of static set of changes and a static set of documents. And that has meant that his pontificate is interpreted as more liberal than Benedict and John Paul II, and I think that interpretation is basically correct. And there have been sort of specific debates. The most famous was over communion for divorced and remarried Catholics, but there have been a lot of sort of secondary debates where issues that seem to have been closed and settled by the prior popes have been reopened by Francis. But then there's also just a sort of shift that you can see in this, what's called the Synod on Synodality, a slightly self-parodic name that's ongoing in Rome, which is basically trying to shift towards a kind of more open-ended, sort of listening session-driven, layperson-oriented mode of church governance, where there's sort of, instead of Rome issuing teachings, Rome is sort of shepherding an ongoing conversation about what the church should be and stand for and say. And that very clearly, I think, is a return to what more liberal Catholics expected to follow from Vatican II and sort of how the church felt for a while in the 60s and 70s.
You mentioned this earlier, but you say that Vatican II was necessary. What do you mean?
I mean that the core issues that it took up were issues that where the church had to have something new to say. In particular, the church had an often shameful record on anti-Semitism and its relationship to the Jewish people. And in the aftermath of the Holocaust, the church needed to have some kind of reckoning with that history. The church also had a long history of resisting liberalism and democracy in the Western world. And by the time you reach the 1960s, the old regimes that the church was associated with, monarchies above all, are mostly just gone. And that critique, even if you thought that critique was correct, it had become effectively somewhat irrelevant to a world divided between liberal democracy and Soviet totalitarianism. So the church clearly needed a kind of political teaching that was acknowledged the world as it actually existed, rather than pining for the world of 1788. And then, obviously, the church was headed into a period where it was going to be affected by the same social revolutions as every other religious body, the sexual revolution above all, but the whole transformation of decolonization and globalization and information technology, all of these things were just beginning to be felt in the 1960s. And what I think the liberal side of the debates about Vatican II has gotten right is that more and more new things were happening, and the church's response to those things couldn't simply be static. There had to be the line, the famous line about tradition from the famous Italian novel, The Leopard, is in order for things to remain the same, everything has to change, right? And that sort of, I think, is an overstatement in certain ways, but it does reflect a wisdom that to preserve tradition through turbulence and change, you need to be adaptive. And that was the ideal that Vatican II set out to reach, of being adaptive to the new world of the second half of the 20th century.
You say Vatican II is also a failure. How so?
Well, it didn't work, right? I mean, in just at the most basic level, the church did not become more evangelistic after Vatican II. It was not a period of sort of rich cultural fruitfulness that the secular world could learn from and admire. The church went into crisis and then into steep decline just about everywhere in the developed world. The only real places where Catholicism has seen real growth in the last 50 years is sub-Saharan Africa. And in Western Europe, countries like France and the Low Countries and Germany that had deep Catholic traditions, the church went into incredibly swift decline. The decline has been a bit slower in the United States, but neither the documents of Vatican II nor its implementation saved the church from crisis and decline. And so the best you could say in Vatican II's defense is, well, maybe it all would have been worse if the council hadn't been called. But when you've reached a point where 1% of baptized Catholics are going to Mass in certain regions of the Netherlands and churches are closing all over Europe, it's hard to say that it just would have been worse without the council. There had to have been something else that Catholicism could do. And I think the critique of the council that traditionalists offered, that basically it sort of unsettled everybody and undercut the church's authority by changing so much so fast in such a complete way, I think both in data from the 1960s and data from today, I think that's been reasonably vindicated. The liturgical revolution in the life of the church, and I say this as someone, I don't go to the traditional Latin Mass, I go, you know, go to the new Mass and always have, but that revolution did not lead in any way to a sort of new springtime in Catholic life.
Ross Douthat is our guest. We're talking about Vatican II. When we return, how did post-1960s Catholicism become even more inwardly looking than before? Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
Memoria Press award-winning Latin programs have successfully taught hundreds of thousands of students across the world. Their easy-to-use, step-by-step Latin curriculum provides students with an academic vocabulary, a mastery of English grammar, and strong critical thinking skills. If you're interested in learning more, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next purchase by using the coupon code LPR23. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free.
Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University, Chicago.
Indeed, the quest for truth is at the core of a university's purpose. The liberal arts, illuminated by the revealed truths of Scripture, are powerful for equipping students for a life of self-governance. A disciple is one who follows the Master. So what does it mean to follow Jesus? He said that it means to take up one's cross. The cross is thus the symbol of dying for others, of dying to self for the sake of serving others. And a life of service is a life well lived.
Truth, freedom, vocation. Concordia University, Chicago. CUChicago.edu.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Ross Douthat of the New York Times about his column, How Catholics Became Prisoners of Vatican II. Ross, you say that post-1960s Catholicism became even more inward-looking than before. What do you mean?
I mean that we ended up with endless debates about what Catholicism should stand for, what Catholics should believe, were permitted to believe, what the Church should teach. And again, some of that was inevitable because the sexual revolution especially created new debates that had not existed 20 or 100 years before. But it created a landscape where Catholic intellectuals, Catholic journalists, all the way up to now Catholic bishops, were constantly feuding with each other about questions that had been raised by the council but not settled by the council. And that just, I think, inevitably turned the Church into a more inward-looking body than, oddly, it had been in prior decades. It was insular in other ways prior to Vatican II, but in terms of sort of the arguments it was making to the culture, the arguments Catholicism makes now are intensely and insistently arguments about itself. Should the Church change this way? Should it change that way? And that limits your ability to present yourself as an institution that's primarily offering people the message of Jesus Christ.
You say that Vatican II can't be undone. Why not?
Well, the mechanisms that the Church used, right, to implement the Second Vatican Council were mechanisms of authority that no longer exist. That it's kind of amazing in hindsight that the whole Church just accepted the wholesale renovation of its entire centuries, or depending on what you believe, millennia-old liturgy. It just accepted it. This just happened. If you did something like that today, if Pope Francis were succeeded by a very traditionalist pope who said, guess what, folks, we're just going back to Latin, right? It would break the Church. And you see this on the liberal side, on the conservative side, the sort of Catholics are now accustomed to arguing with each other, arguing with popes, resisting popes. The translation to an information age spiritual landscape means that everyone on Twitter is a church unto himself or herself. And these are changes created by broader changes in the culture, broader changes in technology, but they're also the fruit of Vatican II itself. No one is more of a post-Vatican II Catholic than a newspaper columnist like me criticizing Vatican II as a Catholic, right? Like, that's the landscape we're in right now. So any kind of alteration in the life of the Church, whether you're trying to liberalize or trying to restore or trying to create synthesis between the old and new, it can only work if it happens, I think, gradually as a work of generations. The church's ability to sort of change itself really quickly and have ordinary Catholics accept it has mostly evaporated.
Is any kind of synthesis or restoration possible?
Yes. I mean, look, I'm a Catholic, so I don't think I'm obliged to see the work of the Holy Spirit in everything the church does, but I do think I'm obliged to maintain a hope and expectation that periods of crisis in the life of the church, and this has been one, will give way to periods of synthesis. And I think there are ways in which it's possible to imagine a future liturgy for the church that doesn't simply revert back to the, you know, the precise rubrics of the Mass in 1961, but reintegrates some of what was put aside and lost. This was something, this idea of the reform of the reform was something that Benedict the 16th was very interested in. It's sort of fallen on hard times lately, but I think it's still, again, over generations, a plausible path forward. I think there are plausible integrations, and there have to be integrations between traditional church teaching on sexual morality and a celibate priesthood and the very real changes in the role of women and the changed view of the dignity and capacities of women in the modern world. I think the sort of quote-unquote liberalizations of Pope Francis that I'm most in favor of have included trying to put more women in positions of leadership in Rome and in the bureaucracy of the church. And I think there is some plausible synthesis there and many other such examples. But I don't think there's sort of a faction within the church that's offering right now a sort of a simple, full synthesis that just puts everything back together. And I think conservatives under John Paul II, because he was such a charismatic figure, sort of convinced themselves that he'd already done this. He'd offered the synthesis. We were set. All we had to do was implement it. And I think the hard work of the Francis era has been that no, any synthesis is still in the future.
So what did Vatican II break in Catholic life and practice?
It broke the strong attachments that lots of Catholics had to church customs and traditions that for a long time prior to the council were sort of definitional of who was a Catholic. It or its aftermath broke the sort of a sense of political unity. Not that Catholics were exactly politically united before the council, but it's only really after the council that you get these clear factions that are liberal in theology and liberal in politics, and conservative in theology and conservative in politics. And then I think the loss for a time of aesthetic tradition in the life of the church, the ideas of beauty and symmetry that had been important to church architecture and liturgy and music for a very long period of time, a lot of that was just lost for a while. And I really do think that a lot of Catholic architecture in the 20 years after Vatican II is going to seem like sort of more unforgivable than any other mistakes that were made. So those are just examples.
My church body, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, was heavily influenced by some of the things, especially the spirit of Vatican II, not for the better in my opinion, but what can non-Catholics learn from post-Vatican II Catholics?
Well, part of what they can learn is that there's, in moments of sort of renewal and transformation, it's easy to give in to a kind of hubris. And the 60s in general were a kind of period of hubris all over the place. There's a way in which the changes to Catholicism look a lot like sort of high modernist city planning and, you know, these sort of ideas that brilliant architects could redesign cities without thinking about how people actually lived in them, right? And that's I think, for anyone thinking about church reform on any question, the idea that you can just sort of do it from the top down and assume that the Holy Spirit must be working through you because you happen to be in charge, I think that that perspective is a dangerous one, and that realistically, any and all reform, unless you're just trying to tear up pure corruption, has to start from how people are actually praying, how they're actually believing. what they're actually doing on Sunday, and not only on Sunday, and not assume that you can rewrite that from above.
Ross Douthat is a columnist for the New York Times. He's author of several books, including To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism, and a recent column titled How Catholics Became Prisoners of Vatican II. You'll find a link to his columns and To Change the Church at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Ross, thanks.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Tuesday on Issues Etc., we'll have Pastors Brian Wolfmiller and Brian Ketchelmeyer respond to your unanswered Bible questions. Send your questions to talkback at issuesetc.org. Post at facebook.com/issuesetc. Send us a tweet at issuesetc or call in your question to the Issues Etc. comment line 618-223-8382. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
You can help save lives in Southern Illinois by participating in 40 Days for Life, September 28th through November 6th. Vigils will be held outside abortion facilities at Granite City, Carbondale, and Fairview Heights, Illinois. For information on Granite City, visit 40daysgc.com. To learn more about Carbondale and Fairview Heights, go to coalitionforlife.com. You can protect mothers and children by joining the worldwide effort of 40 Days for Life, September 28th through November 6th.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.